For the week of May 9th, 2010, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 53, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Cannes, France, I am a very tired Jay Sperling Reich.
And always in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And also at the Cannes Film Festival, I'm Michael Giltz. And I'm not tired in the least.
Well, you've been here for a while. Not in Cannes, of course, but on the European side of the world.
That's right. Yeah, so we're sorry you're not here, Karen. Some year we'll have Showbiz Sandbox from Cannes with everybody present. This is my 11th year here, and I typically go visit my sister in London, and then I take the train into Cannes. I have a lovely, delightful 8-9 hour train ride. I read, I relax, I stop in Paris, and then I arrive a few blocks from my doorstep. What about you, Sperling? How was your trip to Cannes?
Of course, Michael is setting me up because he knows that my trip to Cannes was about 36 hours long.
Oh.
And I was one of the, I count myself among those people who were affected by the Icelandic volcano. So I left Los Angeles and landed in Salt Lake City, where my plane was delayed by 3 hours because of the Icelandic volcano, flew overnight to Paris Charles de Gaulle, where I had already missed my flight to Nice, which is the airport you fly into to get into Cannes. And so I was told, look, there's no flights left that are open to Nice today from Charles de Gaulle. And while I'm standing in line, Karen, you're going to love this as the queen of social media. I said, I'm going to try this whole Twitter thing. I know that it worked really well for Kevin Smith with Southwest Airlines. So I sent out a little tweet or posted a little tweet that said, I'm standing in the at Air France FR line, which has not moved in an hour because I missed my flight to Nice. Well, lo and behold, they get in touch with me asking me to...
On Twitter.
To follow them so that they can direct message me. And and the funny thing is, all they said was, there are no more flights. All of the flights from CDG, Charles de Gaulle, to Nice for the rest of the day are booked. Sorry. Have a nice flight. Which I thought was very...
Ah!
I thought that was very funny because I thought, wait, you just told me to have a nice flight, but previously you told me that you can't actually accommodate me. So I had to take a bus from Charles de Gaulle to Orly, the other airport in Paris, and on the way I'm running into traffic. And I said, well, I'm on my way to take an Air France, you know, at Air France FR flight from Orly to Nice, but my flight leaves at 7 and I'm going to be delayed because of the traffic. Well, they sent a Twitter post back or a Twitter message back saying that hopefully I would arrive in time, but if not, they had booked me on the 8 o'clock flight.
Wow.
So that helped.
So there is Twitter in action, used, I think, quite nicely by both myself and Air France. So kudos to Air France.
Wow, yeah, major kudos.
Is that a little annoying, though, complaining about your trip to Cannes? I'm looking at a Twitter from Russell Crowe, a tweet, I should say. He's on Twitter, and he arrived at Cannes, and he said, so far, Cannes as glamorous as a sausage sandwich. And he's complaining about the hotel taking too long to steam his suit.
Do I think it's obnoxious to do that? No, it is when Russell Crowe does it, but when Jay Sperling Reich does it, I think that's what Twitter should be used for.
Yeah, no, and I'm not complaining. Look, if that was the worst thing that happened, then fine. You know, I was delayed by about 9 hours, but I made it here. Michael, who was supposed to arrive 8 or 9 hours after me, wound up beating me by 10 minutes, but still, all's well that ends well. A little tired, but have a wonderful story about social media to tell.
And Karen, if you can picture us, instead of being on different coasts, right now Sperling and I are shoulder to shoulder talking on the same mic. So it's sort of the side-by-side episode. I can punch
him
in the shoulder.
That's so romantic.
Well, we are sharing a bed, too.
That is very true.
Are you guys really? A hotel room or a bed?
A bed.
Well, yeah, actually, we are staying in the equivalent of the clown car of apartments here in Cannes, as do many journalists who are forced to literally pay their own way to Cannes and then have to figure out how they're going to afford it with the euro being so expensive. It's like at $1.28 per euro, and all the accommodations are between 4,000 and 8,000 euros, so that's quite expensive. So there's like 5 of us staying here in this one apartment. And Michael and I are sharing this big, giant bed. which is not uncommon also. Not that journalists tend to spend their evenings with Michael, but they tend to sleep in the same beds.
You keep telling yourself that.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'm digging myself in deeper, I can tell. So actually, what I should say is that we do have a lot of news, entertainment news, in fact, to cover, not just, you know, air travel news. We're going to be talking about, of course, box office. We'll turn it over to Michael in just a moment. We're going to be talking about Taylor Swift. We have, unfortunately, some obituary news. We'll talk a little bit about Cannes in preparation for it. And we're going to talk about how song lyrics are making some news online. And if that is confusing, just stay tuned. Michael's going to fill us in on American Idol, and I'm sure, Karen, I'm sure you'll be able to join in. And then we have a whole bunch of Big Deal or Big Whoop, and we're going to do some follow-up with the FCC in our Inside Baseball segment. The FCC had a very important ruling this past week, and Karen, I'm sure you know what it is. But before we get to any of that, as always, we turn it over to Michael, who will fill us in on this week's North American and hopefully a little international box office news.
Well, to my shame, I did not see any movies this weekend because I was traveling and in London. There's actually a cool movie in London I wanted to see, but I didn't get a chance. It's about Muslim bombers. It's a comedy. Muslim fundamentalist bombers in the UK.
Obviously.
Actually, that's supposed to be a great movie. It was in Sundance. And it's supposed to be
hilarious. Oh, was it?
Yes.
The guy who did it, Chris Morris, is a journalist, and he does very, very interesting stuff. I think it's his debut film. But the biggest movie all over the world, of course, was Iron Man 2. It grossed $135 million, I think, if you include the Thursday night grosses.
$128
including? All right. And worldwide, it has grossed $333 million so far. So it's a big hit. It's one of the five biggest openings of all time, I think.
What did we bet on last week?
I think I said 120 because it made $98 million last year, and I believe I said, well, it should make about $120 million.
Yeah, I think we'd have to go back and listen, but I think we were all in the 115 to 125 range.
Yeah.
And now, mind you, of course, everybody thought it would make 140, including Paramount, who told, you know, all of the journalists and media outlets that it had made $133 million by Sunday evening, but they had overestimated by about $5 million.
But the nice thing is people aren't making their expectations the news. It's one of the biggest openings of all time. It's a very solid gross. It cost $200 million to make, of course, but it's going to make $600, $700, $800 million at the box office, and it's a big hit. Thank you, Robert Downey Jr. At number two is the opposite of a big hit, A Nightmare on Elm Street, the reboot. It dropped a massive 72%. Still made $9 million, $48 million total. And traveling to Cannes in the French subway, the Paris subway, the posters for the movie, the big word is Freddy. All it says is Freddy. And then it has something about A Nightmare on Elm Street in French below that. But it just says Freddy. That's all you need to know.
Awesome.
Yeah. And number three was How to Train Your Dragon, $6.6 million. It just passed $200 million. Date Night is chugging along. It just passed $80 million. The Backup Plan is at number five. It's made $30 million total. And then a few, you know, movies carrying on. Furry Vengeance is dropping fast. Clash of the Titans is now at $430 million. I think $430 million.
That must be worldwide.
$443 million worldwide, yes. So in a funny way, How to Train Your Dragon cost more and grossed less. Clash of the Titans cost less and grossed more. But the winner in everybody's mind is How to Train Your Dragon. Did you see anything this weekend, Karen?
I didn't go to the movies, but I saw The Young Victoria on DVD. But you know what I did do is that I went to the Century City Mall to go to the Apple Store, where I was virtually ignored because clearly it wasn't cool enough. These ads for The Prince of Persia. Are you guys just giggling?
I saw your tweet.
Are you guys just giggling when you see this?
I actually saw the movie.
And?
I actually saw the movie.
How is it?
Yeah, I saw the movie.
Oh.
Oh!
Yeah, I've been told that if you have nothing nice to say, you shouldn't say anything at all.
I put something up on Facebook about it, and people will not stop commenting on it. They're like, it's the gayest thing I've ever seen.
I have a friend on a gay blog. All he keeps saying is, he's in some movie, I don't care what it's called, but he's shirtless in the poster and I want to see it. There are a few little weird details as I was looking at the box office that popped up. Martin Scorsese's Shutter Island is still chugging along overseas. It's grossed $293 million worldwide. It's his biggest worldwide hit of all time. It just passed The Departed. Interestingly, it's Leonardo DiCaprio's third biggest hit of all time, behind, of course, Catch Me If You Can with Steven Spielberg, and Titanic, which I think shows how he's really not tried to be in big, massive hits. He's really, you know, a serious actor who's tried to make a lot of serious, challenging films.
Like What's Eating Gilbert Grape?
Well, great movie. Yeah. And finally, Tyler Perry was on the list. Yeah. Oh, yeah. He was the cutest homeless kid ever.
In Growing Pains?
Yeah.
The television show.
Like,
yes.
He would be homeless for more than an hour. Are you kidding me?
God. No, because Sandra Bullock would pick him up. Everybody knows that.
And, well, speaking of Sandra Bullock and Black Babies, one other movie on the box office list was Tyler Perry's film, Why Did I Get Married? 2. It's at $60 million, and I wondered what it was making worldwide. I don't even know if it's been released yet. So I went to check. Worldwide, it's at $60 million. It has not been released overseas. Then I went looking back at his early movies. I don't think they've ever released a Tyler Perry film overseas. They don't even try. Not one of them has been released overseas. They haven't made a dollar. Even in the UK, they don't try to release. I find that really fascinating.
Get Lionsgate on the phone. That's got to be wrong.
I bet Tyler Perry's never been released overseas. We'll have to check into that.
Well, before we move on to other news, we have a few sad notes, a few obituaries. Over the weekend, legendary jazz singer Lena Horne died at the age of 92. She was, of course, as many people said in their obituaries, an enchanting jazz singer and actress who spoke out against the bigotry that allowed her to entertain white audiences but not necessarily socialize with them, thus slowing her rise to Broadway and movie superstardom. And on screen and on records and in nightclubs, concert halls, Horne was at home vocally with this huge range, musical range, from blues to jazz, and she also did some Rodgers and Hart songs like The Lady is a Tramp and Bewitched, Bothered, and Bewildered. Of course, she is probably best known for a little hit called Stormy Weather, which she did in a 1943 20th Century Fox film when she played Selena Rogers.
I don't know. She might be best known for being Bill Cosby's, you know, the object of his affection on The Cosby Show.
Okay, well, okay, good point, yeah. You know, to us, maybe, but not to people who were raised in the 1940s, where she, you know, she was the first black performer hired to sing with a major white band and the first to play at the Copacabana nightclub and, you know, among a number of Hollywood clubs, in fact.
I saw her perform at Lincoln Center in a tribute to Billy Strayhorn, the gay composer who worked side-by-side with Duke Ellington on some of his biggest hits. And she was in her 70s at the time, I think. And this was a rotating night with a lot of different stars performing. And she strode out there towards the end, like, and took control. And she was, I'd never thought much of her because she hasn't really recorded a lot of great albums. She's really a live performer. And so, I mean, I respected her and I knew she was talented, but I'd never seen her in person and I'd never heard a great album by her. She came out there and just blew me away like five songs. And she had that audience, you know, in the palm of her hand immediately. It was pretty thrilling to see at that, you know, in the 70s. She was in, you know, she was great.
Okay, so let's move on and talk about Can't.
I'm very excited. It's sort of a weird little year. Terry Frimo sort of downplayed the selection this year. But you've got a lot of big names. You've got Oliver Stone, Emmanuel de Oliveira, and
Oliver Stone is here with a Wall Street movie, and there are several films dealing with Wall Street and the economic crisis, including Wall Street 2 from Oliver Stone and Michael Douglas and Shia LaBeouf star in that, Inside Job, which is a documentary narrated by Matt Damon that examines the causes of the economic meltdown, and then other political movies. Doug Liman is here with a film, the only American director with a film in competition with Fair Game, when it's a film about the Valerie Plame CIA scandal in which the vice president's top aide, Scooter Libby, was, and I can't believe, you know, people still call him Scooter Libby. That's not his real name. It is not Scooter. But he was convicted of breaking
the
law. No, it's not his real name. I think that's a Muppet, actually. he was convicted of breaking the law when he ousted Plame's covert status to smear her husband, former Ambassador Joe Wilson. And it stars Naomi Watts and Sean Penn, so that should be quite interesting.
I'm all over that. It looks so good.
The longest film in the festival is Carlos. It's about Carlos the Jackal, the assassin from the 70s. It's 5 hours long. It's by Olivier Assayas, who I've never really liked. But his last film, my friends really liked it. It was very atypical for him. It was called
I don't know. Michael is looking at me going, it was called what?
It got a lot of nice reviews. And it's 5 hours long. I always make sure I go see whatever the longest film is at the festival in any category. Because my feeling is if it gets to this festival and it's like 5-6 hours long, there must be a reason they picked it.
Cannes is known for films that are butt numbers. So, I mean, I guess what premiered here that was like 8 hours long? The Che Guevara film was like,
oh yeah,
it was like 8 hours long. 4 hours each part was 4 hours, and that was the Steven Soderbergh film. I mean, that was ridiculous how long that movie. They had to serve dinner in the middle of it.
But you've got Ken Loach, really? Mike Lee.
What?
Oh yeah, they had a break and gave you food.
Wow.
But you've got a new film by Godard. You've got Ken Loach, Mike Lee. You've got
Ken Loach with a kind of a last minute ad. They added him over the weekend.
And a lot of big players from Asia, Thailand, Japan. So there's a lot of interesting stuff.
And there's, you know, and that's just the stuff from the official competition. And certainly there's the director's fortnight, which is just down the street. That's kind of a sidebar to the festival. And then there's Un Certain Regard, which is kind of, I don't know, how would you describe that section of the festival?
It's for either veterans that they want to give a slot to, but they don't think it's good enough to compete, or they don't want the pressure of competing. And it's for young people who are moving their way up. This young Canadian director, Xavier Dolan, had a big success last year with I Killed My Mother. And it was released in Canada and did well. It won 3 awards in the Director's Fortnight, got a lot of attention. And this year he has a new film called, I believe the English translation is Heartbeats, but it should be My Imaginary Lovers. And that's in Un Certain Regard.
I have plenty of those.
He's working his way up. He went from Director's Fortnight to Un Certain Regard, which means in 1 or 2 films he'll probably be in competition, assuming he continues to grow as an artist. So it's also one people coming up and people going down.
So it's kind of the place filmmakers go to be discovered
and
the place they go to die, which I'm sure is not the case.
Nice. But,
and yet Godard and Manuel Oliveira and Godard are probably both in, you know, out of competition or in Certain Regard.
Yeah, Woody Allen has a film here out of competition. And, you know, Blue Valentine, the film that I really enjoyed that was at Sundance, is screening in Un Certain Regard. And I believe that's because it had already screened.
Say it like that again, Sperling.
Un Certain Regard.
Oh, yeah.
That's my Pepe Le Pew voice, by the way.
Oh, wait.
I should probably do the whole show in my Pepe Le Pew voice.
Oh, let's not.
Go on. Sorry.
So we shouldn't tease you. Next week, we'll certainly have a lot of coverage about the movies we've seen. If we don't do another episode in between, before or after, who knows what will happen. But it's very exciting. The one interesting thing is that there are far fewer posters, billboards, elaborate displays for upcoming movies. You usually see them lining the Croisette, the main drag of the festival. They're notably fewer. They've been decreasing the last 3 or 4 years, clearly a reflection of the economy. And you're seeing fewer newspapers. You know, the big papers are still coming, but a lot of the small papers don't send the reporters anymore. And you're seeing a huge rise in online people. No big surprise. You were speaking to a Cannes official. Tell us what he said.
Well, we spoke with somebody today when we were picking up our accreditation who has been working here for a good number of years. I mean, we're talking maybe not decades, but take the S off and you've pretty much hit the nail on the head. And he said that when he started, there were about 40 online journalists, myself included, I guess, and myself, Eugene Hernandez from IndieWire and a few others that were accredited by the festival. They didn't really accredit a lot of online outlets. This year, however, the number of online outlets has increased to about 350 out of what? I think it was
2,000? 1,500?
1,500, I believe he said. What he was stating was that the number of online outlets is surpassing and usurping the number of print outlets that they accredit.
Well, slowly.
Slowly.
It's not yet. One-fifth of all journalists are now online only. But it does lead into our next story. I put this item up. This is about the magazine Newsweek. They are up for sale. The Washington Post put them on the block, and they said, by the way, it lost $30 million last year. It's been losing tens of millions over the last few years, and isn't that a bummer? I mean, who reads, a weekly news magazine? It's almost impossible to do anymore. Nobody, it falls between the cracks.
I do.
It's not Time.
I read Time magazine every week. I read the actual
God
magazine.
Bless you.
So old-fashioned.
Well, the house I'm living in right now gets it as well, and I do look at it sometimes. What makes you keep subscribing? The fact that it's $10 a year now, or what?
The fact that they sent it to her for free, and they haven't actually remembered to take her off the subscription list.
That probably has a lot to do with it. No, there's something about... I still haven't mastered the art of curling up on my couch with my laptop.
You need an iPad, I believe, is the problem.
Yeah, or that, too. Yeah, I still like holding a magazine and... Mm-hmm. And doing it the old-fashioned way.
There's a place to say, let's take a break. Let's have some deeper, slower, big-picture insight, not feel the need to break stories all the time. But they do have a problem. You know, they could be with the Sunday papers, and there's things like The Economist and other really well-done magazines, or The Atlantic or New Yorker. And the sense of telling people what the big news is of the week is sort of gone for them completely, you know.
But look at I would agree with you. The Economist is a great example of a magazine that has really excelled in the weekly format. Likewise, The New Yorker. Those magazines and those outlets have editorial content that you cannot find anywhere else. And they're long, in-depth stories at times, very analytical stories. Certainly some fiction stories in the case of, I believe, The Atlantic Monthly and The New Yorker. Yeah. So you're not going to find that anywhere else.
But they don't specialize in breaking news.
No, they don't.
But Newsweek doesn't break news anymore, do they? Not really.
But they used to. I mean,
yeah.
You know, or their cover meant
something.
Well,
certainly The New Yorker does break news. I would say The New Yorker does break news a lot. Their Iraq coverage, but not like a newspaper organization. But they do have articles that make news.
They're more on
Well, they have articles that make news, but they don't break news. I mean, and that's what I think, you know, physical magazines are really good for, is really getting into the real details of the story. And and that's not what digital is good for, because people don't want to read that much
online. But you know it's going to be gone soon, right?
Yeah, that too.
Well, maybe you were traveling already, Michael, but did you see the Daily Show with Jon Stewart, and when the editor of Newsweek was on this past week? He was on the day that this was announced. And he comes out, and Jon Stewart was like, so how's the day going? I felt bad for him.
Did he have a good story to plug, or what was he doing on there?
I can't remember what he was doing on there, because all I could think of is, oh my goodness. Could you imagine being either the producer or...
They were thrilled.
Yeah, I mean, or worse, the editor of Newsweek, who has to sit there and...
But it's the best place. John is a very friendly interviewer, so it's a good place to get your side out.
Yeah, kudos to him for not begging off.
Yeah, that would have been bad. So Newsweek is losing tens of millions of dollars, and it's up for sale. Maybe I'll buy it. In an entirely unrelated story, the online news site Slate reported a 30% increase in ad sales in the first quarter.
I love Slate.
Well, there you go. And Slate is part of a string of online news sites like BigMoney.com and ForeignPolicy.com. And that collection of news sites, their total ad sales went up 50% in the first quarter. And who owns the group? The Washington Post, which is the same company that is selling Newsweek.
Wait, the Washington Post owns Slate? Mm-hmm. I thought Microsoft started it, though.
Washington Post owns it.
Okay, so maybe they sold it in the meantime. Yeah. I'm sure they did, and I just missed forgot the headlines. Okay.
So that's where the money's going. You know, the economy's picking up. Online sites are making money.
But Slate has always been online, and so they always knew how to work it.
Yes.
They had nothing to learn. They figured it out a long time ago.
Well, part of being online is knowing what works and how to work it, knowing what headlines do well on Dig, knowing how the length of a story
and links.
Yeah, they know how to work it. Whereas traditional media and mainstream media is really just beginning to figure that out. Like, oh, gee, if you write a headline like so, it gets picked up by other outlets and linked back to, and we get more traffic. They're just now beginning to learn that.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, their learning curve is so steep, whereas Slate has mastered as much as you can.
Right. Maybe we could just actually say the same thing in different ways for the rest of the podcast.
Because we usually do that.
Yeah, I know, but you know.
And of course, Slate is part of a group of sites that are interrelated and send readers to each other, which of course is what also happening with IndieWire.
That's right. IndieWire, of course, we've had Eugene Hernandez on here. We were actually hopefully supposed to meet him this evening, but we decided to prep the podcast instead of go to La Pizza.
Can we talk about it for a second that we did not get the scoop about Tom McCarthy going to IndieWire? Hello?
Well, you know, we don't necessarily break news either. We analyze it.
Yes. And give you that insider
perspective. Yeah, but we had Anne on with us. Like, we were talking about it.
Yeah, but I don't think at the time it had just happened, and I don't think even she knew that it was going.
Let's assume she totally knew. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I'm going to assume she didn't, and therefore that's why she didn't
tell
us. We don't
care. We're a podcast, so we go out like 4 days later after we record, so it's not the place to give news.
Right. And so, you know, Todd McCarthy used to be the chief film critic for Variety, and we talked about him in a previous episode, and he was let go by Variety after 30 years. He is now on IndieWire. He has his own blog on IndieWire.
That's unbelievable.
As does Leonard Maltin. As does Sidney Levine, who is formerly of Film Finders and IMDb. So IndieWire, and kudos to them, is slowly beginning to grow with some very talented writers and contributors. So I'm looking forward to seeing what they deliver.
So are they giving them a piece of the company, or how are they bringing them in?
I have no idea. That would actually be a very interesting to find out. Maybe we should invite Eugene on to talk about that, or even some of the people that they've brought on. I mean, the reality is, where is Todd McCarthy going to go? Who's going to pay that salary for a film critic these days?
Certainly IndieWire's not paying that salary. I mean, it's absolutely not. Of course not.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah. No. We know they're not paying him six figures to write for IndieWire.
No, but I mean, if he has an audience, then people will flock to IndieWire.
But he never blogged regularly before, did he?
No, and he actually talks about that in his first blog post. Hello World is the name of his first blog post.
Yeah.
How much do you think that the writers, bloggers, whatever we want to call them without insulting them, for Deadline Hollywood Daily make? Seeing as they are not necessarily an ad-run site.
I could not answer that question. I have no idea. I mean, I know that
yeah, not a lot.
I don't know. Without knowing their traffic, I couldn't tell you. I mean, knowing their traffic and knowing what the average CPM is, I could begin to figure it out. But it would be pure speculation.
What's the name of the company that bought her?
Mail.com.
They have a lot of money.
Sorry about that. Talk about the death of print media. Leonard Maltin goes from Playboy to IndieWire. I mean, wouldn't you rather work with Playboy?
I'd rather work at Playboy, that's for sure.
I have a friend who was...
photo department, please.
Yeah. Very nice.
I knew somebody who interviewed for a job there to work in their digital department, like, yeah, in photos. He was like, man, I want this job. He's going to be a content manager. It's like, that's awesome.
I had a friend who worked for them. He was gay.
what a waste.
I'm like, can you at least do work for Playgirl?
Well, we should probably move on to music. We'd have our little intro, our little in-between music here. But we don't have it.
Oh, wow.
In unrelated music news, so I'm looking at the New York Times today, and there's this article about how these sites that offer music lyrics to popular songs, which I love because "Excuse Me While I Kiss This Guy" is not the name or lyrics for the song that Jimi Hendrix sang, not Purple Haze.
It is when I sing it.
There's the title for our podcast, "Excuse Me While I Kiss This Guy." So apparently they're getting into a little bit of trouble because the sites that post these lyrics aren't actually licensing the lyrics from the songwriters.
Some of them.
Well, they weren't initially. And there was this story, and it featured in this story, was Milan Tesovic, and pardon me, I'm sure I butchered that name, but at the age of 16 in 2000, he started this website, metrolyrics.com. And it now has, at least in March, 13.5 million unique visitors and is making annually $10 million. And so, of course, this has attracted the attention of the record labels and the songwriters unions, and they're going after these sites looking to recoup some money. But, you know, the more I thought about this story, the more I felt like, how much money could they possibly recoup? Are these sites going to pay more than a radio station would for broadcasting the song?
No, they wouldn't pay more, but they're certainly, they're using content they have no right. They're using the entire song. They absolutely should be paying. You know, they have no rights to these songs. They didn't write them. They don't get to reprint the entire lyrics. People print books of lyrics of Bob Dylan, all these people. It's perfectly good. They build a business. They're making money. And they're going, by the way, you don't own that. We want X percentage. The music people should be getting much, if not most, of the money, you know. And you go to a lot of artists' website. They feature lyrics on their website. I search for lyrics all the time. So it's a smart business that they created, but they absolutely have to pay royalties. It won't be like playing in a song on the radio, but I'm sure it all adds up. Tens of million, $10 million for Metro Lyrics.
I mean, but that's probably the most popular site out there. And I guess for me, Lauren Appolito, the vice president of business development at the Harry Fox Agency, which sounds kind of like an agency out of a movie. But, you know, for me, I look at that and she says, you know, that most of these people are doing that, posting these lyrics out of ignorance, not malice.
Yeah, but I think she's referring to casual people. Like if I put lyrics on my own personal website, she's not talking about these companies that have artists and their entire catalog up. They're not doing it out of ignorance. They're doing it out of malice.
Well, out of greed. Well, out of, you know.
Yeah, they want to make money.
What do you, I mean, Karen, do you ever look up these sites to find out whether this person is kissing a guy or a girl or whatever the case might be?
Look up lyrics?
Yeah, that was a really bad callback of my poor joke earlier.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because when I was writing my master's thesis on Gwen Stefani, and so I looked up not only all of her lyrics, but all of her husband's as well. And they are way easy to find, although you notice that Gavin Rossdale's lyrics are about like three words a line. It's really funny, whereas hers are like these grand stories. You know, it's interesting that we don't really give lyrics their proper due in a way because, you know, I mean, they are in a way not any different from books, poetry.
Right. Well, I mean, they're not meant to be read on their own per se, even though you can, but they certainly are a serious part of art. But I find most critics give more credence to lyrics because it's really hard to write about music and rhythm and melody. And so most of the time, most rock critics concentrate on the words because I don't even know what instrument they're playing, much less what key it's in. So, you know, that's why a lot of critics avoid that stuff. But what did you find out in analyzing their lyrics? What was the idea of your thesis?
My thesis was really about why she was such a universal icon that most people really, really loved. It was interesting though, because when I was writing it, it was right in the transition of going from No Doubt to her solo album. So I ended up kind of with like two theses, one of why everybody loved Gwen Stefani when she was with No Doubt and why everybody loathes Gwen Stefani when she's just Gwen Stefani.
Because when she was with No Doubt, she was just a girl of the world.
Did you get sick of her lyrics having to watch him so much?
Well, I'm so sick of Gwen Stefani, I can't even tell you. But yeah, like Gwen Stefani solo was more of a hollaback girl. And how did her lyrics play in? Well, it was actually pretty important. Because her lyrics that when she wrote as Gwen Stefani are incredibly inane. And it makes her look, you know, like a brilliant in comparison to the songs that she wrote for No Doubt. But like Hollaback Girl being one of them, there was one writer, actually I want to say it was for Slate, completely tore apart Hollaback Girl and was basically like, this story is about a girl who's a total bitch. And just went line for line. This is what the lyric says. This is what it means. And you're like, yeah.
That's a good song though.
No, it's a sucky song.
Well, whatever the case might be, it looks like the record companies, the songwriting unions, they are going to have some problems collecting these royalties. It's not easy to collect them. And over the last year or two, they have reached out to some of these sites. And I guess a number of them, 95 sites that were carrying unlicensed material, they reached out to, 9 of which actually obtained official licenses. 31 just shut down. And Peter Brodsky, an executive vice president at Sony, which is a major publisher, said, every week there is some new potential income for lyrics. The revenue is not significant now, but it's just the beginning. And I kind of wonder, given that they're not going to make tens and tens and tens of millions of dollars, is it just goodwill to let fans publish these things? I guess not when they're making $10 million.
They're not talking about fans. They're talking about sites like Metro Lyrics rent every song by every popular artist out there. They're not talking about some fan who's got a Justin Timberlake, I love you website and prints a lyric to one of his songs.
Well, now Metro Lyrics started out as a site because the guy couldn't find the lyrics to a song he wanted to research.
But he turned it into a business.
And he turned it into a business. And I think that's where it possibly crossed the line. But now, speaking of music and turning music into a business, there are some people that are on TV trying to turn their own musical not tastes, but aspirations into a budding business. And of course, I'm talking about American Idol. So I'm going to turn this over to Karen and Michael, who actually watched the show. And I will find out, along with you, our listeners, what the heck this is all about.
Karen, are you watching?
No. Oh. This crop of kids is so boring.
Well, that's what everyone says. They really do you not even like Crystal? Crystal Bowersox?
No. Well, I watch enough of the show that I know that I like Crystal. Yeah. She's pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah, she's really cool. Well,
and her
there's a lot of
cute.
Her brother is hot. I think it's her brother.
Is that who it is? No, I think it's her
fiance. No. Her boyfriend is cute. Her brother is hot.
Really? I don't know their brother.
For those of us who have no idea who you're talking about or have never seen them, what's going on in the world of American Idol?
We're down to the top four, and Crystal Bowersox is the preemptive favorite. She's probably the most preemptive person who's going to win since Carrie Underwood just sailed to the finals. Everybody knew Carrie Underwood was going to win. There was never a doubt. And there really hasn't been a doubt for Crystal for weeks and weeks, even though she's had a rough week or two.
But yeah, but she's had a lot not going for her. I mean, looks wise, she's adorable, but she's got that hair. She's got dreadlock hair. And she's had problems with diabetes. She's had to be in the hospital like 3 times. One time she almost left the show. But in a way, I think that kind of worked for her after a while.
Oh yeah.
You know, we all felt so sorry for her, and she's just really adorable, and she's definitely got the pipes.
But people want to say, oh, the show is over. The show is done. Let's run through a few of the things that are going on. It's going to be the number one show of the season. Week to week in the last few weeks, it's being beaten by Dancing with the Stars. But overall, for the whole season, because of the huge numbers it does early on and the huge numbers it'll do as we get to the finale, we're in the top four right now. It's going to be the number one show in the country for the sixth straight year. And that no show in U.S. history has ever done that. Only 3 shows have been number one for 5 years. 2 of them did it in a row, All in the Family and The Cosby Show. They were each number one for 5 consecutive years. 60 Minutes was number one for 5 years, but not in a row. American Idol is the first show in history to do this. That's amazing. The season's been dull. It's absolutely true. It's still the number one show in the country. It's Simon Cowell's last season. It's Ellen DeGeneres' first. She's going into her role. They're going to name a new judge and have that person come in next season. Randy Jackson just launched a record.
Do you like Ellen as a judge?
Well, you know, she had a slow start. She's getting better and better all the time. It's a lot harder than it looks, I would say. I watch at home and go, I could do better than that. And I could. But
to me, this is just proving why she should never have been a judge in the first place.
No. No, it's hard for anyone. Cara DioGuardi's been better. Ellen is getting better all season long. She's sort of effortlessly funny now. She's not shoehorning the comedy in. Her comments are still a little vague as far as what she likes and doesn't like, but she's clearly a cheerleader. And when she doesn't like you, like when Paula didn't like you, it's really a bad sign. But she's been better and better and better every week, and she's coming into her own. And I think she's a good presence on the show. Randy Jackson launched a record.
She looks so uncomfortable.
No, she doesn't. Not in the last 3, 4, or 5 weeks. She's really relaxed into the role. It's not easy. She's a new kid on the block. Anyway, Randy Jackson launched a record label, and his first signing is Kimberly Luck, who was one of the season 2 finalists. And you might be thinking, good Lord, how sad is that? But you know what? She's had 8 top 20 hits. She's had 8 top 20 hits on the adult contemporary charts. She's written hit songs for other people. She's had 3 number 1 dance hits. She's had 8 number 1 hits overall in various charts. She's also had 3 number 1 Christmas hits. You know, and she's one of a gazillion idols who are doing well on Broadway, in film, in music. You know, the show is clearly not going anywhere. Chris Allen and Adam Lambert are on the charts. And according to Forbes, American Idol is by far the top grossing show on television. For every half hour it's on the air, they gross $8.1 million in ad revenue. So that means if there's a 2-hour show, which there is every Tuesday, they gross $32 million, you know, just from that one night. That show is a massive, massive moneymaker. The second show to be the top ad revenue, way behind, less than half, is 2 and a Half Men, which grosses $3.1 million. And we'll have a link to the Forbes list so you can see all the shows in order and how much they gross. 24 is still in the top 10. It's kind of an interesting list.
Not that we're going to talk about this, but I heard that Charlie Sheen, who may be here for Wall Street too, that he said, look, you pay me $2 million per episode and I'll come back to Two and a Half Men. We'll see whether that's
true
or if it actually happens. It probably won't.
Well, people have gotten $1.5 million, $1.8 million or whatever. So that's not, you know, that's if it's grossing $3.1 million, why not?
Why not? Because I'll tell you why not. We have to talk about Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the biggest entertainment news stories of the week and whether anyone should care about them.
And to clarify, a big deal is a big deal. It's a thing that people think is really exciting, and a big whoop is just
a
nothing,
deal that
at
big.
Least in American slang.
And let's just provide a little teaser for what you're talking about, Michael. Michael knows that we're going to read a listener email coming up in which we talk about that very subject. But our first big deal or big whoop item of the day is the Dreyfus affair. In a scene worthy of Seinfeld, actress Julia Louis-Dreyfus got her star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, only to discover they had misspelled her name. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's only a big deal for the person who made the typo error. Otherwise, it's really kind of, it's a big whoop, and kudos to Julia Dreyfus for laughing it off. But whoa, if you were that person who didn't double check, oh.
Well, and if you were that person that didn't double check, you're really thanking David Daniel, a CNN producer, for pointing it out before the ceremony had started. But yeah, you're right. Oof. She laughed it off. And, they gave her the misspelled chunk of concrete as a keepsake. Michael, what do you think?
I say it's a big whoop about that, but it's a big deal that in writing about this story, Sperling misspelled Julia Louis-Dreyfus's name. Come on. If you're going to do a story about misspelling her name, you've got to get it right.
Do you know how...
No, you guys, it's a typo in the URL.
What? No, he forgot the hyphen. He didn't put in the hyphen.
Oh,
who cares about the hyphen? Look at the URL.
Oh, you're right.
That would be in show notes.
Well, speaking of television actresses making it big, Saturday Night Live is finally funny again, according to many people. Betty White was the guest star last weekend, and in an unprecedented event, skit after skit was actually pretty funny. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's sad that it's a big deal, but it's true. Literally week after week after week for years, they can't write a single funny. You can't believe they put it on the air, some of these skits. So if they can do a good episode this time, why can't they do it all the time?
Because they haven't been saving up all their Buddy White jokes for 9 years. Karen, what do you think?
I think it's kind of a big whoop because I think Saturday Night Live kind of was dated a long time ago and it should have just been relegated to clips online.
Did you watch the show?
I heard it was funny.
I keep meaning to watch it, and I'm embarrassed to admit that I have not seen it.
Well, you talked about clips online. Michael, do you want to take our next item here?
Sure. This is an item from the UK. The US falls way behind most of the industrial world in the digital download speed, our wireless network. We're way, way behind Japan and Europe. And digital download speeds in the UK and other parts of Europe are about to hit 100 megabytes, which is about 50 times the average speed in pokey United States. This means you could download a feature film in about 2 minutes. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Big whoop. That's all I had to say. Okay, so what? What's the argument here? That piracy is going to go up?
Yeah.
Yeah, piracy is going to go way up, but I'll tell you.
Sperling, is this a big deal?
I think it's
a big whoop.
I think it's a big deal because it will force the United States to actually have to increase the speeds at which they offer.
I agree. That's the bigger deal here.
Yeah, and you know, I've been, what was it, last year I was in Amsterdam and I saw billboards 100 megabytes down, and I think it was 50 megabytes per second up. Megabits, I should say, not bytes. It was like $30. We pay like $50 for 7 megabits per second down.
And by the way, that's only the promised possible top speed. When look at the speed you're actually getting, is that they're like, oh, well, that's just your possible potential top speed. You don't actually expect to get that, do you?
When we checked into our apartment here and finally got online, we tested the speed here and it was like, woo, a whopping 2.5 megabits per second and down and a quarter of a megabit per second up. So,
but that's because we're on somebody's cheapo system who's paying less than whatever.
That is correct.
But the problem, as Karen says, is that this will open the door for people to steal movies and TV shows the way they've been stealing music.
Well, Michael is actually...
Did you just yawn?
Yeah, he's falling asleep. We're going to have to actually power through the rest of this. Come on, Michael, you can do it.
Okay, let's do it. Let's do it.
We're so darn tired. Okay, well, this is just kind of
what time is it there right now?
I don't even know.
Oh, it's not late. It's like, one in the morning.
We are recording this over 2 days. We've been recording this podcast for 2 days.
Go.
Okay, this next item is a bit of a follow-up. Bret Michaels is alive. Of course, he is the lead singer of Poison, and he dodged a bullet, not a literal one, but kind of a figurative one. After spending 10 days in intensive care at a Los Angeles hospital, Bret Michaels has been released, and not from prison, just in time to do a cover story with People magazine. Michael, what do you think? Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, except, of course, for him.
Karen?
What is the question, really? That he's alive or that he did a People magazine cover?
Is it a big deal that Bret Michaels is still alive? Or that he's better, I guess.
It's a big deal to him.
You know, what's funny is we were just talking about...
I don't think he did this for publicity. That's the question.
No, you know, what's interesting is we were just talking about the death of print media, and People magazine is just knocking it out of the park.
Make a lot of money.
Yes, first they get Sandra Bullock's interview and her adopted baby, and then they get Bret Michaels' interview.
Ka-ching.
Yeah, good
which
grief.
They paid him. Wonder what check they wrote him.
To me, the most interesting thing about this is how he just manages to keep himself relevant just like all the time.
I don't know if he's relevant, but he's in the news. But no, you know, People magazine does make a lot of money.
Well, speaking of people who are relevant, Taylor Swift, the artist who wrote or co-wrote hits like Tim McGraw, Love Story, 15, and Fearless, she's going to receive an award from the Songwriters Hall of Fame, joining this year's fellow award recipients like Leonard Cohen, David Foster, and Phil Collins. It's unbelievable. All of those people have, like, established...
massive careers.
She's like 20. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
You know, it's a big deal. You originally in this post said what the actual it's the Hal David Starlight Award at the Songwriters Hall of Fame. I mean, I don't know what the Hal David Starlight Award is. I mean, is it awarded to people under the age of 25 or
No, it's not. It's not for young people, but it's just, you know, Hal David's Burt Bacharach's co-writer, and it's just a tribute to talent.
Kudos to her. She's a good songwriter.
Michael, what do you
think? Who cares that she's 20?
Yeah, I think it's a big deal. She's had a rough, you know, time. She won Grammys and all that stuff. She should be on top of the world. But people kept going, God, she can't sing.
But because you know what?
She is a good songwriter.
She's a great songwriter. And yeah. God, she can't sing. Yeah. Okay, our next and last item in this week's Big Deal or Big Whoop. Last week, we reported that Lindsay Lohan was dumped from a movie and that the director took the unusual step of saying it was because investors thought she was unbankable. Well, not all investors feel that way, apparently. Now Lohan has been cast as a porn star and born again Christian, apparently. Linda Lovelace is going to star in a new film called Inferno. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal for her. As we said, that little setback, she's had too many good movies, she's too talented, she'll come back out of it, and it's probably a very juicy good role. I'm not familiar with the project, but it's good for her.
Well, supposedly it's going to be announced here. There are rumors that she will appear here in Cannes. We'll find out. Rose McGowan and Anna Faris turned down the role. Karen, is it a big deal or a big whoop?
You know, we'll see. I don't know anything about this project either. It could be not real. It could be a bad script. We don't know yet. But I have to say, its casting is pretty good.
Yes. Well, that's it for Big Deal, Big Whoop. But we do have a reader email to read.
Actually, that would be a listener email. I made that mistake last week of calling it a reader.
Well, they read the website and then they listen to the show. It's from Rory, who says, Dear Sperling, apologies in advance if you are fed up with this observation. Not celebrity dirt, I'm afraid. Simply a message to say how much I appreciate the podcast. I don't know where else to send it. I started listening after hearing you on CNET's The Real Deal podcast. I really wish I could say I was moved to search out Showbiz Sandbox solely because of your informed presentation and witty banter. But actually, I loved your voice. It reminded me so much of Richard Dreyfuss. And I thought, I want to listen to that voice for an hour each week. Apparently, Rory has taken a bottle of Chianti and sidling up to the iPod and listening to Sperling's dulcet tones. Richard Dreyfuss presents news from Hollywood. What's not to like? Being a listener in the UK, even after turning in for several months, thank you, Rory, I do still have to make a mental adjustment for the Big Deal, Big Whoop segment. Over here, our definitions are more or less switched. A big deal is a big so what? So I have a little bit of a huh moment when you introduce the segment. where you decide if it's a big deal or if anybody should care about it. Mind you, having said that, it becomes a moot point because Karen and Michael disagree often enough that most news items turn out to be both a big deal and a big whoop. Anyway, I just wanted to thank you for putting in the work each week and producing a very enjoyable podcast. Thank you again, Rory. Well, cheers to you, Rory. Ta very much. And keep listening and tell all your friends to listen to.
I was going to say, and a shout out to Lewis, who messaged me on Facebook that he likes the podcast too and that he likes the fact that Michael and I always disagree. And one thing I forgot to tell you guys earlier, that he totally agrees with my views on 3D.
Well, and Rory, thank you very much. This is Sperling. Thank you very much. That email made my week.
Yeah, Sperling, he knows that it's your voice. You don't have to introduce yourself.
A good point. I forgot. Good point. Yeah, I mean, I have to say I was a little like, wow, this is probably the best email we've ever received.
My God. I'm sleeping with Richard Dreyfuss.
Oh, my God. There's the title. Of all the titles that ever, that is a perfect title. I'm sleeping with Richard Dreyfuss.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my. So after I was done blushing, I said, should we read this? And I think there was, you know, pretty much it immediately went into the show notes. So thank you very much, Rory. And again, we are on iTunes. For those of you who don't know, please feel free to give us a rating or review on iTunes of, say, 5 stars, Michael. What do you think?
Yeah, five stars. We're going to need a bigger podcast. That's all I know.
Did he say that?
Size matters. Size matters.
Oh, my God. Before this show gets completely out of control, we should probably move on to Inside Baseball, our popular segment in which we discuss the week's
obscure industry news.
Yeah, can you tell
stuff that only insiders really pay attention to, but will affect everybody, and we'll explain to you why.
You know what? Can you tell who's had more sleep? Certainly, that would be
Michael.
Yeah, Michael wins. This story actually is kind of a follow-up on some stories we talked about in the past. It involves the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission in the United States, and they are going to allow movie studios to block the copying of new video-on-demand releases. And what this means is that studios have always wanted to prevent all of us at home from being able to TiVo or record on a VCR anything that we purchased through video-on-demand or pay-per-view. Now, the way they do this is by sending a special signal along with the movie that blocks the recording. So you would have to send the movie through a specific output. In this case, it would probably be HDMI. They call this Selectable Output Control, or SOC. Now, we've talked about this before. When the signal goes through your cable or satellite dish set-top box, it will be blocked from going through, say, a DVR, a TiVo, a VCR, DVD player, anything that can record it. And the FCC said, we believe that providing consumers with the option to view films in their homes shortly after those films are released in theaters will serve the public interest. And of course, they went on to say that they really feel that, it would help, handicapped people and people who are unable to go into movie theaters. Now,
please,
do movie theaters feel this way? No, they are really ticked off that this thing went through because their fear is that studios will say, well, now that we can prevent people from copying and pirating the movies through video on demand, what we'll do is we'll release Robin Hood on May 12th, and then shortly thereafter, maybe a week, maybe the same day, maybe 2 weeks, we'll release it for video on demand. You want to watch it at home? It'll cost you $30. You want to go to the movies? It'll cost you $12. You make the choice.
This really has me annoyed because they've been offering video on demand for years, so they didn't need this technological fix in order to do it. It's just a backdoor excuse. They don't really think, oh, we're desperate to show movies earlier video on demand. You have to give us this ability to block recording. It's crazy. As John Bergmayer of Public Knowledge, a public interest group, wrote on Friday, what other high-value content deserves a waiver next? And this is the only one with this waiver. Live sports? The season finale of Mad Men? It's really opened a Pandora's box of problems where they'll be able to block you from fair use of time-shifting the shows and the product that you watch. It's just, it's bad on every level.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the FCC came down firmly on the side of distributors over exhibitors or movie theater owners on this issue. And they said its purpose was to give the studios the incentive to offer their most popular movies to home viewers more quickly. So,
but why should they care whether they offer it more quickly or not?
Because they're trying to save the movie studios, according to
Studios, the multi-billion dollar grossing movie studios who make
really
tons of money.
Saving.
Well, the studios have formed and contribute to the Motion Picture Association of America, the MPAA, who is probably best known for rating our movies in the United States, but most recently what they've really been focusing on is movie piracy and legislation in Washington. And they succeeded here in convincing the FCC that the decline in DVD sales meant that they needed to find another source of ongoing revenue, and that source was video on demand, and that they shouldn't be spending tens of millions of dollars on a marketing campaign in May for the theatrical release of a film, and then waiting 4 or 5 months to release that same film on DVD or on VOD, and then have to spend that same amount of money to market it all over again.
But what's it matter if it's 4 or 5 months or 4 or 5 weeks? They've been doing video on demand anyway. So why do they need this fix? If they want to release video on demand the next day, they can. It's the same thing they do 4 months from now. That's the issue of when they release the window, when they put it on video on demand, on pay-per-view, on DVD, has nothing to do with this technological thing, which is just the studios trying to block people from fair use of the material that they purchase.
Well, fair use is watching it once, and what the studios are trying to prevent is piracy, and that I can understand. And
yes, and then they put out a perfect master copy on DVD, which any pirate can take and put out all over the world. Give me a break.
I realize it's too early for anybody to have any answers, but sometimes I really feel like no one's really sitting and thinking things through in a logical way and thinking things through, what's going to happen 20 years down the line, 100 years down the line. It's like they think with only like, well, what's going to happen next week?
And all it does is screw up average consumers. I remember trying to hook up a VCR to my TV. I wanted to make a mixtape of scenes from all these Christmas films I own so I could play it on a loop while I had a Christmas party. Classic example of fair use. 30 seconds, a song from this movie, a scene from that movie. Just mix them all together. That's it. And my VCR, literally, I couldn't press the record button in because they had it blocked when you had the DVD player playing. And so, piracy prevented.
You know, all of these little technological handcuffs really wind up hurting those people who are following the law, not breaking it in the first place.
Yep.
So, with that said, might I add, please feel free to pirate our podcast.
For the love of God, please pirate our podcast.
And having said that, I guess we should probably wrap up here since it's after midnight here. It's pretty late. If you want links to any of the stories that we discussed in today's episode, feel free to visit our website, showbizsandbox.com, where you will find links to all of the stories we discussed in the show notes for episode 53. Our website is also where you will find links to all of our social networking accounts, including Twitter, which our username is @showbizsandbox, Facebook, LinkedIn, YouTube. By the way, on YouTube, there's some Coachella video that I've posted.
Cool.
So go check that out. There's also ways to contact us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is the way to send me some really great emails about how wonderful I am and how I sound like Richard Dreyfuss. And dirt@showbizsandbox.com, dirt@showbizsandbox.com, or call us and leave us a voicemail, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace, myspace.com/MGMT, or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Both Michael and Karen, of course, write for other outlets, but they have their own website, or websites, I should say.
Although if we got married, we could have our own, Michael.
Hey, wait a second. Do I need to sleep on the couch? Because, Michael Giltz can be found at his website, michaelgiltz.com, where you can find all of his writing. He's also on Twitter, @MichaelGiltz is the username to look up. Karen Woodward is on Twitter, @Karen_Woodward is the username to look up if you want to follow her on Twitter. KarenWoodwardOnline.com is her website. Some of my writing can be found on CelluloidJunkie.com, or I can be found on Twitter. @Sperling is the username to follow. Probably just a few days from now, when we hope to do a few special episodes before the next weekly podcast. Until then, play nice.
We'll be right back.